May it please the court, my name is Irene Dimkar. This is an appeal of a decision on an attorney's fees and costs petition in a 1983 civil rights case. Let me start by saying that we shouldn't even have to be here talking about attorney's fees. This case should have settled early.
That's
in the case.
Completely irrelevant. Let's discuss the legal issues.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I would say that
All right, if you want to waste your time, go ahead. But following suggestions from the bench is usually prudent.
Of course, Your Honor. Of course, I'm also reminding myself of the Richardson case where the court held the plaintiff, criticized the plaintiff for not dealing with settlement early on. And here's a case where plaintiff tried very, very hard to settle this case. And I think that the settlement history should be part of the legal analysis in this case.
Okay, but because time, you know, you don't have a whole lot of time. On the district court's double counting of the 84.2 hours for reliable recovery work, the plaintiff contends, you contend, that the city had an opportunity to correct the mistake when the court was rendering the oral judgment. So I'm assuming, but I could very well be wrong, that you had the same opportunity to correct the mistake at that time. What I'm wondering is why, if you did, then would your failure to step forward at the oral ruling be a waiver of the issue?
No, Your Honor. We brought a motion for reconsideration. That's exactly what motions for reconsideration are intended for. This could have been resolved at this point. This was an arithmetic mistake that the judge made. But the judge was saying this is a new issue. You can't bring up new issues. Our motion for reconsideration said, look, Your Honor, we had voluntarily taken off 84.2 hours. They said it was 128.2. We didn't know until the judge rendered his decision that he was going to add the two together and basically discount it twice. We brought the motion for reconsideration with the idea of that's how we're going to resolve it. There is an error here. There is an error here. And the city, at the oral argument, at the point where the judge issued a summary decision, because he didn't require the city to respond, the city attorneys just rode the wave and did not say anything, and the court got it wrong again. They say that there's a waiver, but how is there a waiver? How can you waive an objection to a decision before the decision's even made? We didn't know that the judge was going to make an error until he rendered his fee decision, and at that point, we came in and brought a motion for reconsideration. So I think that was a proper vehicle to proceed with. And in their brief, they do not deny that an arithmetic error was made. They do not deny that at all. And in fact, if you read the brief, it seems that they're agreeing that there was an arithmetic error. Well, why didn't this get resolved sooner then? There are also hours beyond the 84.2 hours, and we said to the court, these are the other 44.3 hours. We said, you know, that's you're deducting the depositions of Timothy Gaddotti, his boss, Juanita Horton, who owned the car, Oliver Johnson, and these were, the court had awarded summary judgment based on this legal work. These are all people who were subpoenaed to come to trial. They all testified except for Jurkovic. So these additional hours should not have been deducted either. But when there's an arithmetic mistake made by the court and you bring a motion for reconsideration and the judge stands firm that you can't bring it up at that point, I'm not sure what else we can do. I'd like to talk about the 50% reduction because that's a reduction of $164,000 in legal fees. The court said there was a limited success, but a jury verdict of $30,000 is not a small amount. It's a reasonable amount under the facts of this case. This was not a case where we aimed high and fell short. This wasn't a million-dollar case. We never asked for $1 million. In fact, going to the jury, I never even asked for an amount. I just left it up to the jury, and the jury got it right. They awarded $30,000. Now, had this, if we had dealt with this sooner, we could have settled the case for $30,000, plus nominal attorney's fees and nominal costs early in the case. But to say it's not a big verdict, when that's all you reasonably could expect out of the case, that's saying that the little guy, the guy with a small claim or smaller claim, a person who didn't suffer catastrophic injuries at the hand of the police, can't bring a claim. Or if you can't bring a claim, you're going to have to litigate it. You have to get to go the whole nine yards in the case. The judge also said, the court also said, that the Kenneth Baker didn't win all his claims. But he won at least one claim against each of the defendants who went to trial. And he won the main claim. He actually won it at summary judgment, the false arrest claim. I'm not going to get into the facts of the case because I know that you all are aware of it, but the police barged into the house to arrest Kenneth Baker. The arrest was the main claim. It was the core claim. Everything else had to come in, whether there were other claims, whether there were other plaintiffs. All the rest of the evidence had to come in because the family was all there when it all happened, and the prelude, the reason why the police were in the house, that all had to come in. That all had to come in whether those other claims were there or not. So what it is not fair in this case was I am asking the court to deal with the issue that plaintiff had to go to trial. It was either walk away from the claim, even though we won summary judgment, walk away from the claim because the city was not negotiating, or proceed to trial. The number of hours that we are claiming in this case, it's 800 to 900 hours, is not extraordinary for this kind of case. It was a case that was litigated over 4 years. There were 17 depositions. There were many witnesses to this case. This was not an extraordinary number of hours. I would like the court also to note that the defendants' objections, their spreadsheets, are disorganized, they're confusing, they're contradictory. It's very difficult to respond to their objections because they're very sloppy. If you go to page 46 of my brief, there's a chart where I set forth all the contradictions, where they said that deduction should total 3.5 hours, and they claim it's 8.1 hours. 5.9, they say totals 14.6. I think what happened here was the district court he didn't want to go line by line through the fee petitions. This is an arduous task for me, for this court, for the district court. I think the judge said that, you know, this is just so confusing and doesn't add up that I'm going to deduct a flat 30 hours. But he didn't look at what it was that the defendants were claiming, or the defendant, because it's the city of Chicago, what the city of Chicago was claiming was excessive. And they said, or was vague. They said 25.1 hours were vague, but that included 22.3 hours to review 17 deposition transcripts. Some of those depositions took 7 hours. So we were over 1,500 pages of deposition transcripts. So, you know, when the judge, I understand that the judge is allowed to take a flat amount off, but it has to be based on something. And if you look at what the objections were by the defendant, they're very disorganized. They do not add up. They're contradictory and they're confusing. There was 9.9 hours where we said, I'm not going to go through each category here because it is tedious. But there's 9.9 hours where we said it was attorney time. They said it was paralegal time. The judge gave no fees for that. And, you know, it's difficult to determine what the city was complaining about in the 9.9 hours, but reviewing paralegal work is not paralegal work, it's attorney work. And when paralegals and attorneys work together, attorneys still have to review what it is that the paralegals do. There's no doubt here that the city is really the only party on the other side when it comes to attorney's fees and costs. And what we have argued in our bill of costs argument is the plaintiff should not have been denied bill of costs. Defendant was granted bill of costs, plaintiff was denied. And we're saying that in a small case, and I will get back to this in my rebuttal because I see the time is up, this would have a chilling effect on plaintiffs bringing civil rights claims in smaller cases. If they have to pay costs, even if the jury gives a smaller award to the plaintiff. Now, I will return on rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Breyer.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This court should affirm the judgment of the district court. I'd like to address what looks to be opposing counsel's, Mr. Baker's, two primary arguments, the allegations regarding double counting and... Sorry, Your Honor.
Would you concede that the court, in fact, did make a mistake by double counting the 84.2 hours of the time the plaintiff had already deducted for liable recoveries hours? I mean, I was trying to figure out why the plaintiff should have anticipated that the court would make that mistake.
It sounds like two questions there. I'll try to address them in turn. First, based on what the court said, there's nothing to indicate that there was not a mistake. The only possibility that might cut against that, and that this is pure, I admit this is pure speculation on my part, is that the city, when formulating its response, cut off at a certain point long before trial. There's a possibility the district court was intending to include time past then. There's a significant amount of litigation past. It was summary judgment where the city cut off. The district court may have intended to include some time that was spent specific and reliable in that. But that's that again, that's pure speculation on my part. So it would require a remand if this court went to that issue.
Are you conceding that the court made a mistake?
I'm willing to concede it appears the mistake was made, yes. That as the court formulated it, that it listed time twice.
Why didn't you just...
Sorry, you cut out, Judge. You're completely cut out, Your Honor.
It's probably good that I cut out, because I'm
regarding that issue, however, this court need not reach it because the district court found waiver, and there was, in fact, waiver. It was not an abuse of discretion to find waiver. On appeal, Mr. Baker argues that there was no possible way to anticipate this, but that was not the argument he made below. In the district court, in his motion to reconsider, Mr. Baker came out with an entirely different theory of how this went down, that the city intentionally attempted to mislead the district court, and the district court fell for it. And the district court specifically addressed that argument and said that wasn't what happened, that it believed that the objections were clear and that Mr. Baker had an opportunity to raise this in his reply in further support of his fee petition. Found a waiver there. Now on appeal, Mr. Baker makes an entirely different argument. Seems to have abandoned the argument that the city has attempted to intentionally mislead the district court, but says now that could never have anticipated that this would have happened. But that runs directly counter to the argument raised below. Either the city was intentionally trying to do something, was specifically requesting something happened, or it was an inadvertent misunderstanding. Mr. Baker, you know, that piles another waiver on top of waiver in this case, and we believe that waiver can resolve this issue without reaching the double counting. And again, just to clarify, Your Honor, Judge Rovner, we are willing to concede that on this record that double counting appears in the district court's decision. I apologize for how it sounded like I might have been trying to equivocate. That was not my intention.
No, I understand. You know, I have to tell you, I am troubled that the defendants recovered all of their costs, given that, you know, you did lose some of the claim. Why didn't the court apportion the costs to reflect the split verdict? I mean, did the city fail to differentiate which costs were for each claim?
There was no differentiation, but there was that was true of both of all of the bills of costs submitted to the court, and this argument was not made. Actually, the district court found specifically that the argument that Mr. Baker's argument requiring segregation had been waived, that could have been raised in an objection at some point, but was never raised. It was never requested that partial awards be made, that there be some allocation of costs between the parties. And to get to your initial point that that the city did lose, we do admit that we did not win. We lost on the false arrest claim and on at least on two claims. But under First Commodity Traders, this court explained that a party still can prevail despite that fact. In interpreting Rule 54, explained that's not a bar to being considered a prevailing party for purposes of costs. And given the sheer amount of litigation, a sheer number of claims on which the city prevailed here, that it was well within the district court's broad discretion to determine that the city was the prevailing party. Even based on unfortunately, the trial transcripts were not provided in the record by Mr. Baker, so there's no indication to this court of how this case was litigated. But Mr. Baker's even indicated in his arguments to this court that significant effort was put into this case, 17 depositions, some of them 7 hours long, for a $30,000 recovery total for on only two claims total, one of which was resolved at summary judgment and didn't have to be litigated on the merits at trial. The district court, with its broad familiarity with how this case was litigated, how the arguments were made, what the city had to do, what Mr. Baker tried to do, this was well within its discretion to determine that the city prevailed, that the city prevailed on what this court said is the substantial part of this litigation. And given that Mr. Baker did not request any sort of division of costs, that seems particularly within the court's discretion here. Finally, that segues nicely into my last point I'd like to raise here regarding the 50% Lodestar deduction. This court explained in Anderson that when a prevailing plaintiff in civil rights litigation requests fees that are a substantial multiple of the damages acquired, that the district court is encouraged to carefully review the fee request to make sure that unnecessary time that, you know, So we'll go through all the various factors the court considers when evaluating a Lodestar. That's precisely what the court did here, and it found that a 50% Lodestar reduction was appropriate in light of limited success. Again, only two claims. Plaintiffs prevailed only two claims out of, by the district court's count, 22 against the city. There was no difficult issue. The summary judgment was on a basic issue of Illinois law of assault or battery. I'm not sure where the line is there. And that there was no broader based impact beyond the average impact that any civil rights litigation has. Mr. Baker did not, in his reply below, did not even dispute limited success. It wasn't until his motion to reconsider that he began disputing whether he had limited success. That was too late, and that waived the issue. The district court was entitled to rely on the submissions the parties made, and having no dispute on degree of success could take that into account against Mr. Baker. And this court even recognized in Montanez, in a strikingly similar case, with a 50% Lodestar reduction for the exact same three factors considered here, found that was well within the bounds of the district court's discretion, and even rejected the argument being made here that the plaintiff was not aiming high. The conduct of this litigation, even as counsel's presented to this court, objectively indicates that counsel is aiming high. That, again, 17 depositions, 7 hours apiece, the district court could reasonably conclude within its discretion that counsel would greatly overvalue this case and received only $30,000 and could address the Lodestar appropriately. If this court has no further questions, we respectfully request that you affirm the judgment of the district court in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further, counsel?
Just a few points, Your Honor. First of all, the 7-hour depositions were their depositions, and the 17 depositions were almost all
noticed by
them.
Pointing is not appropriate.
No, I'm just saying, okay, I apologize, Your Honor. It was the defendant's depositions. They were the 7-hour depositions. They're the ones who noticed up 17 depositions. We noticed up the defendants. The point about the bill of costs, just briefly, Kenneth Baker win summary judgment, be awarded $30,000 by the jury, and not be a prevailing party? It doesn't make any sense. And if it's a case where this is a mixed result, where the court says, well, the costs would just be a wash, that's not fair to the plaintiff who has a smaller civil rights case. It would have a chilling effect on someone who has a smaller civil rights case. If a person got, for example, $8,000 from a jury, there were $10,000 in costs for the plaintiff, $10,000 for the defendant, and the court said, well, neither side gets costs, then what happens is the plaintiff would have to give over his $8,000 to reimburse the plaintiff's attorney, plus still owe $2,000. It would have a chilling effect on smaller cases to divide it that way. It's not just extraordinary cases that are supposed to get the lodestar. It's just the lodestar is the presumption. It's not that extraordinary cases are the only ones who get the lodestar. Regarding the 50% and the number of claims, the importance of this court's decision in this case is that you may force, by your decision, plaintiffs to bring a one-claim complaint. One claim where we call it a Fourth Amendment violation would include false arrest, excessive force, illegal search. And then either the plaintiff wins or lose. We don't have to play with these crazy fractions, 4 out of 6 or 2 out of 20 or 11 out of 13. It's either a win or a lose. And some plaintiff's attorneys have started to do that. They just have a one-claim complaint. And then you either win or lose, and it's very clear. Now, bringing a one-claim complaint would give less clarity to what plaintiff's alleging, and there'd be more confusion through discovery, and jury instructions would be really confusing. But maybe that's what we would be pushed to do. We're not trying to squeeze every penny out of the city of Chicago, but plaintiff's attorneys do run businesses. 1988 allows reasonable compensation for attorney work in civil rights cases, and we're saying that plaintiff's attorneys here should be reasonably and fairly compensated. Thank you.
I'd like to ask one, if I may. I appreciate that plaintiffs run businesses, but back to your remarks about chilling effect on plaintiffs bringing small cases. Is there anything? Will our decision here affect the award that Mr. Baker receives from the jury verdict?
It won't affect his $30,000.
Okay.
No, but we have to plan. You know, there is an effect, of course, of every case that comes out of this court, and if what we have to do is tell a client we can't pursue all your claims because
that wasn't the point of my question.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Did I answer your question?
You did.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.